everybody. Dave Consolazio alongside Sam Saig for episode 10 of Running the Option. Sam, I usually ask you how you're doing at the beginning of every episode, but kind of an arbitrary question this week.
Yeah, I mean, what a time it is to be a college football fan. What we know is that we're coming off of the game of the century, as it's been proclaimed. We have a great candidate for game of the season this week, but sandwiched between them is the worst scandal in the history of college football and one of the worst in sports history. So there's a lot to digest since last time we ran the option.
The only way we can go about this, we obviously have to preface this by saying that this is so much bigger than college football, and we're going to spend a segment on it. We're going to talk about all the things that have come down on Penn State and Joe Paterno and talk about our feelings about it, go into some of the details, and then we're going to put this segment behind us and move into college football. And it's not out of lack of sensitivity. The victims here and everything that's happened are so much more important than the game of college football, but this is a college football podcast, and that's what we have to do. Obviously, we just have to move on and talk about other things. But obviously, before we do that, this is the biggest story of the week for a reason. It is nothing short of a tragedy. And before I get into the details, I just want to ask you, Sam, overall, you know, you've been a college football fan longer than I have. And Joe Pa, obviously one of the faces of college football, just your initial feelings.
Yeah, well, I mean, tragedy is the first word that came to my mind. His firing was inevitable, unfortunately. And when you look at this story, it's as sad as I've seen in sports in a while. It's a despicable story in any part of society, but it's especially disgraceful that it took place in sports involving a coach, an assistant coach in this case. It's complicated further by the fact that it happened in college football, a sport reeling from many years of various scandals, albeit nothing quite like this one. But the most disturbing part of all for me is that it took place at Penn State. Because for so many years, going back to the SMU death penalty long before that and since that, Penn State was the program that college football fans could turn to for doing things the right way, by and large. You know, you might have some disciplinary things here and there, but this program has been squeaky clean for the greater part of the last half century. And Joe Paterno is now in his 62nd, or was in his 62nd season as part of the Penn State coaching staff, his 46th as head coach. And in that time, he averaged 10 wins doing it the right way every step of the way. This is the one school and coach that it took me a lot of time to believe these allegations, and it's still setting in to a certain extent. I think that's part of why you see the students outside of his house and rioting, as sad as it is, because the support for him and his legacy was determined by so many people already. He took the great experiment of trying to successfully marry championship football with academics, and he made it a reality. He's a graduate of Brown University, comes from the Ivy League. Enrollment at Penn State has grown exponentially because of Joe Paterno and his influence. And all of that now comes to a sudden and devastating end. And you know what? It's the right move.
Yeah, that was my initial response when I first heard these allegations and I first started to hear the story unfold. I was thinking, it's a shame that this is how Joe Paterno is going to be remembered. I mean, how do you destroy nearly half a century, more than half a century if you include before he was head coach, of all the great things he did in one day, in one week? Yeah. But as the week went on, and as I familiarized myself with this story, it's not only fitting and correct that this is what he'll be remembered by. It's just the way it has to be, because I just want to go down the list. CBS Sports did a great job of putting everything together chronologically, because this is a somewhat confusing story, an overwhelming story. Yep. No matter where you turn, both on sports networks and major networks, everybody's covering this story. So I just want to go chronologically over some of the key things that have happened. In 1969, it goes all the way back to then, that Jerry Sandusky started his career at Penn State as defensive line coach. In 1977, he found Second Mile, which was a group foster home, and eventually became a charity for troubled boys. Fast forward to 1998, Victim 6, as he's known, 11 years old, showered with Sandusky. His mother reported this to university police after he'd come home with wet hair. Sandusky apologizes to the family, and after talking to the police, he admits that he did shower with the boy naked and had engaged in hugging with him, but he apologized and no charges were pressed. That's in 98. In 99, he retires from Penn State, but he still has status there. He can still come and go as he pleases, as is usually the case with coaches that retire. In 2000, a janitor observes him performing oral sex on a boy aged around 11 to 13. He tells his supervisor, the janitor does. The supervisor says that the janitor should report that to the police. The janitor doesn't. Neither does the supervisor, and this goes on. Then in 2002, a graduate assistant, who we now know as Mike McQueary, sees victim 2, as he's known, 10 years old, subjugated to anal intercourse. He tells his father, he tells Joe Paterno. Joe Paterno tells Tim Curley, his boss, and Tim Curley and Gary Schultz, they have a meeting with Mike McQueary, they talk about it. And what comes out of that meeting, they say to McQueary that we've taken away Sandusky's locker room keys, and we've reported our findings to the Second Mile Group. And that was it. That's as far as it went in 2002. In 2009, victim one comes forward, and more power to him for having the courage to do this. He goes forward and goes to the authorities and said that over the course of a four-year period, multiple times, he was touched inappropriately by Sandusky. The investigation begins. 2010, Sandusky retires from day-to-day work at the Second Mile. And then on November 5th, he's arrested, and all of this starts to come out. The most revolting thing about this story for me is we're looking at 1977, when he founded Second Mile, to 2010, when he stopped day-to-day work there. That's an over 30-year period. And these allegations aren't even scratching the surface, in all likelihood, of how many victims there are here. Because the nature of these crimes, by their nature, so many of them go unreported. Because as victims, a lot of these kids aren't going to tell, aren't going to come out about it, especially as adults after the fact. As revolting as all the things we know are, there are so many more. And it's just, you know, like you said, in no matter what it's in, it's sports or anything, it's revolting, and it's the lowest point of humanity. I mean, this guy's clearly a monster.
And he leveraged his position of power to make himself that much more of a predator, because when you are able to use not only his foundation, but your position at Penn State, a huge university.
And an organization that, like you pointed out, is known
right.
for its prestige and honor.
Everything that he had working for him, and I'm sure he understood this, allowed him to continue to kind of propagate this behavior.
And a lot of these things were happening in the locker room of the football stadium. It's not like they were happening off campus. These things were happening on campus. And that's kind of what I've come to and why I've become so angry with Joe Paterno. A lot of people are saying, correctly so, that this isn't about what Joe Paterno did, it's about what he didn't do.
Right.
You know, it's about that, yes, he went to his boss, and perhaps that is all he was legally obligated to do, but why didn't he do more? Why didn't he continue to follow up? Why didn't anybody? This isn't just a Joe Paterno thing. I mean, you go down the list, there have been at least 10 people that could have done something or said something, probably a lot more. And regardless of their logic, there's no excuse for this to have gone on as long as it did. And I mean, how many victims were there because nobody stepped up and did anything?
I mean, all week, you know, we've heard about this argument of legal responsibility versus moral responsibility. And technically, legally, they may have met their basic duty here. But morally, it's hard to say anything other than each one of them failed across all counts.
And certainly the AD and the guys in charge didn't meet their legal obligation either. Yeah. And I think they'll probably be brought to justice for that. But certainly Joe Paterno did, and certainly Mike McQuarrie did in going to their superiors. But what really gets to me about this, as I was saying, is that you look at, and these don't even compare, and that's the crazy thing about the story. All scandals we've seen before this don't compare. I mean, talking about kids that are getting benefits just doesn't matter compared to any of this. But you look at Jim Tressel, you look at Pete Carroll, you look at guys that have come under scrutiny before, and what the consensus always is these guys were supposed to know that under your tutelage and your football program and your locker room, you're supposed to know. Pete Carroll was supposed to know that Reggie Bush was accepting gifts off of campus. Jim Tressel was supposed to know that his players were signing memorabilia and getting tattoos off of campus. So how was Joe Paterno not supposed to know that this was going on under his nose for arguably decades? I'm not saying he knew and was covering it up. I'm not saying that at all. But if we're going to say that it's a coach's responsibility to know what's going on in his locker room, how do you get a pass for something this huge?
Yep.
You don't.
And while the Pete Carroll investigation and the Jim Tressel, while Ohio State and USC were trying to sort through how to deal with this, Penn State again was used as this beacon of hope. Why can't you look at Joe Paterno and the way he's done it for so long? Who would have known that in the middle of those investigations, we had all of these victims that were, some of them had come out, but most of them were silent. Certainly the reports hadn't gone public the way that we know now. Just incredible that, like you said, if the head coach of a football program is supposed to be where the buck stops, then this, above all scandals that I can think of in the history of college football and also sports even, this has to rank at the top. And it's stunning to think about, because this man for so many years really has done things the right way. And it's been very difficult to keep the program at the level he's kept it at amidst all of the pressure that goes along with kids. And by kids, I mean college football kids.
Right, not victim kids. Yeah.
And I mean, we know how hard it is to manage student athletes, and he's done it beautifully. But this is unforgivable for the Penn State football program, for Joe Paterno, and for the university. And as we've seen, it's affected the university. Forget the athletic department. The entire university now has changed because of this.
Joe Paterno and Mike McQuarrie obviously need to be held accountable for this, but the guys at the top, Tim Curley, the athletic director, it's easy for us sitting here in our chairs to say, oh, we would have done this, we would have done that, and everybody gets in the habit of doing that. Everybody is holier than thou after the fact when they put themselves in somebody's shoes. But honestly, I don't like to do that generally because, you know, I don't know the circumstances or whatever, but honestly, what on earth was the incentive for not turning this over to the police? Was it just to save face for the university? Was it really worth more children going through this for however long it took before it was discovered? Was it just to save face? That's the only thing I can come up with as a logical reason they wouldn't go to the police, and it's a heinous one.
Yeah, I mean, we'll never know what went through the minds of these very powerful people. It has to start with the president, Graham Spanier, and you know, I'm glad in the press conference that we heard earlier that when they went over the changes that Penn State was going to make, the Board of Trustees, and when they had their decision finally made, they started by dismissing him first, and it was the right move, because in reality, it's Graham Spanier that's at the top.
He's the one that's above the AD.
He's absolutely above the AD. He's the one that's in charge. He's the one that should be responsible for this. And then you can go from there, and that's exactly what they did. And there's a reason he was dismissed first, because he is the guy that should have been dismissed first, and then everybody from there, and that's exactly how they've done it. They've leveled the entire power balance in that university. Fear seems to be the thing that comes to my mind. They were so afraid to do anything that they felt like their best move was to stay silent and hope somehow that they could survive this. And it was out of complete fear to me. And they had no idea how to handle it. Like we said earlier in the week, every time they should have made a left turn, they made a right throughout this process. It's an example that will be studied for years as to how not to run an organization and how not to be truthful and be honest and be, you know, forthcoming about mistakes that are of the highest degree in terms of all of this.
Yeah, when you look at past cover-ups, I mean, we're talking about cover-ups of kids going out on a yacht and, you know, having fun with agents.
Yeah.
We're not talking about one of the worst crimes to humanity being covered up. There's just no excuse for this. I mean, most, if not all, scandals we've seen before revolve around somewhat archaic NCAA rules.
And usually financial in their motive.
Yes.
I mean, you know, look at the scandals we've had, at least in the last decade. Almost all of them involve money changing hands to students and agents and things like that. This is on an entirely other level.
Yeah, there's just nothing that can be said in these guys' defense for not doing more. And from a football perspective, can understand why people feel bad for Joe Paterno, but I don't have any remorse. I was disgusted that he was going to be coaching at Nebraska. I said that Penn State firing Paterno was probably the first right turn they've made along the way. And they obviously have
all of the power guys.
Everybody.
At the top.
Yeah,
that was a good move. And they do need to be. The Board of Trustees did get this right, so I applaud them for that.
Yeah, I mean, it was the only move. Right. But there were some people that were saying they wouldn't have the bravery to do it, and they did, so yay for that. But a very small condolence to all this stuff that has happened. But I don't have any remorse for Joe Paterno. I don't. I mean, do you?
My feeling on Joe Paterno is that this will be at the top of the list when you talk about his legacy. But I will not, at least as hard as it is to do right now, I will not forget how many lives he affected in a positive way, because you're talking about 62 years of a lot of very good things. This just happens to be one of the worst things that will come up with his name, and it will define him in many ways. I don't know what his legacy will read in 10 years, because clearly right now this is all we can think about. There's too much about Joe Paterno in terms of doing things right for me to completely ignore that. But this will undoubtedly be at or near the top of the list when you think of his name. And it's incredible to think that that's the case.
No, you're right. Character is defined by more than one act.
Right.
And his character has been proven over the course of his 84-year life.
Right. But this is...
But exactly.
You can't turn your back on this.
I mean, one... thing, one action can define you. Yep. And this is it. This is it. I hate to say it, and I mean, there's a lot of frustration at Penn State right now, and I feel really bad for the players who obviously had nothing to do with this. I feel really bad for the students and for the alumni that you have their names tarnished by this when they obviously had nothing to do with it. I can understand the frustration, and I understand the support for Joe Paterno for the reasons you mentioned, that he's been everything positive about the program for decades. But it's just ill-timed. It's not in the right place right now. These rallies to support him, and all the people that were buying tickets to see his last home game, maybe I'm just being callous here, but it's not the right time.
Yep.
It's not the right time to support this guy. There will be a time, perhaps, when this has all gone on the table and perhaps all the facts have come out and we can really get to the bottom of it. You know, some reports say that he wasn't told about the anal intercourse, that McQuarrie just said to him that there was just some fondling going on. So maybe the way that it was presented to him, he didn't take it as seriously as he would have if he knew the whole story. Maybe this is more Mike McQuarrie's fault than Joe Paterno's fault. I don't know. The point is, there's no degree of child molestation that makes it okay to turn a blind eye to. And the problem with a lot of these people going out in support of Joe Paterno is that even if they're supporting everything he's done up to this point, the perception is that they're supporting this, and they're supporting child molestation. I know that's a bold thing to say, but that's the perception right now. If you hop on Twitter or look at what the media is saying, it's making Penn State out to look like a bunch of idiots, and that may not be fair, but you have to think about your actions. You have to think about what a rally right now in support of this is saying.
Yeah. I mean, it's ill-timed. You know, you can understand where students are coming from when you're young and you're trying to support your coach that's defined your program. I mean, we are dealing with a man that really, you say that no one's bigger than a university or a program, but in many ways, Joe Paterno is Penn State. He's all that you think of when you think of Penn State. That's what happens when you've been there for as long as he has. And so you can understand why with that kind of longevity, you're going to get support from students, but it's just ill-timed. It's not at all the right approach to take, especially when you've taken it to the degree that they have where there's rioting going on. There's just no reason for it right now. Briefly, and as hard as it is, I guess from a college football podcast perspective, we can touch on it. As you look at this Penn State program, and it's a distant thought right now, but we'll touch on it briefly, there's going to be a new president at this university, a new athletic director, and a new football coach for a place, again, that knows nothing but longevity and success. It's going to be culture shock in Happy Valley. And it's going to take a very long time for this prominent and valuable, and by valuable, I'm talking about the third most valued program from a dollars perspective in the country, behind only Texas and Notre Dame. And then you're talking about Penn State as in value. This program will take a long time to rebuild itself. It will not happen in the short term, and I think that's part of why you do see the emotion coming from the students, because the smart ones probably understand that Penn State, as they know it, will never be the same. And so you're going to have emotion because of that. And that's where we're at now with Penn State going forward.
Yeah, the entire identity of Penn State and what it means to be a Nittany Lion is destroyed by this. Yeah, and if you want to talk about it from a college football perspective, recruiting, the football team is done.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing, everybody in this recruiting class,
I wonder who's making the calls.
Yeah, nobody's making the calls right now. And if you are making the calls, what are you saying?
Yeah.
Now, sorry about all that, but the recruiting is done.
Yeah.
Nobody in their right mind is going to want to play here. This isn't something that's going to blow over. I mean, it's something, like you said, over time, Penn State can rebuild. They may rebuild. They may never rebuild. We'll find out. But it's not Reggie Bush. It's not kids taking some benefits.
It's not the SMU death penalty.
It's not the SMU death penalty, which took them decades to get over from a football perspective. It's so much worse than all of that. And from a football perspective, the school is tarnished perhaps forever.
I mean, you've heard.
And for outside of a football perspective, this is a Penn State College perspective that's been tarnished forever by this.
You've heard the name in some reports, a guy like Urban Meyer, that has been rumored already to be involved in the job. But you really have to ask yourself, and Urban Meyer, you know, this is a question only he can answer deep down, is, are you ready, Urban, to take on this kind of responsibility? As good of a recruiter and coach as you are you really ready to step into this program at this time and try to rebuild it? Because whoever does, it's going to take a lot of character and a lot of patience, and I'm not sure who that person is right now. It's just unprecedented territory for any college football program, and maybe even for any university, to try to rebuild after this.
Someone might argue that, you know, this was just one man committing these crimes. I mean, and at the end of the day, it was. But every single person along the way that had any idea that this was going on, that looked the other way, isn't as guilty, obviously, but is certainly extremely guilty and extremely accountable for what happened. Because if any one victim could have been saved by somebody stepping up, that would have been one less victim that this monster ruined the life of. And it wasn't one. It was who knows how many. I shudder to think of how many. And that's why whatever happens to Joe Paterno and all of these guys, I don't have any remorse for. I simply don't.
Now we turn our attention towards what some people are saying should be a game that's canceled on Saturday. Tom Bradley takes over as interim coach. the game, you know, as of now is scheduled, and it's hard to imagine what the NCAA would have to do logistically to cancel that kind of a football game. But that gives you some idea of the perspective of where we're at now. And if the game does go on, I can't imagine what kind of atmosphere and how charged it will be with all the media there and the feelings and the emotion. So you can understand the sentiment for somebody that might want to cancel that game. But we'll see as we get into the week what happens.
I wonder if it will be canceled with these riots going on campus right now, because that's going to be a very hostile environment. They're going to need to have a lot of security there, because I heard this morning when Joe Paterno announced his retirement at the end of the year, this is his last home game, and it was a chance for fans to say goodbye, a lot of these fans that were supporting him, and ticket sales went way up, and there was a lot of interest in the game, because, again, nobody, I'm certainly not saying any of these people are condoning what happened, but they want to thank Joe Paterno for all that he did over the years. And now all these people have tickets to this game that Joe Paterno won't be coaching. And if Nebraska wins this game, or wins it big, there's going to be a lot of emotion, and it's a dangerous situation, and it's why, really, the NCAA does need to consider postponing the game, if not canceling it, because it's a very dangerous environment. And, heck, every week in college football you see hostile environments, but this is a little different, I think.
Yeah, I mean, on a very big side note, this was going to be potentially a record-setting day for Joe Paterno. He's coached 548 games, tied for the most ever. This would have set the record at 549, but for many reasons and in a fitting way, that won't happen, and it shouldn't happen. And that's where we go now with Penn State as Tom Bradley takes over and a new era gets underway there.
And I think the worst is yet to come. That's the sad part. As more comes out, this story is only going to get uglier. So let's switch gears. Hard to do, obviously. But let's switch gears back to college football like we said we would do. And honestly, there's so much to talk about on the football field, so we obviously have to. Let's start with last week, the game of the century. Sam, what did you think of the game of the century?
Well, I mean, before the scandal broke with Penn State, most people in the college football world were talking about two main things as it relates to this game. First, was it entertaining? Like, did it live up to its ridiculous billing?
Right.
And second, should there be a rematch if scenarios came together to make it possible? For my money, it was a fantastically entertaining game.
I agree.
Admittedly, I love defense, but I was very entertained by exactly the kind of game that I think going in we hoped for.
Yeah, I loved it, and I thought it was a lot like a soccer game or a defensive hockey game where every point counted. Yep. You knew that every point was so precious, and all these people that are saying, oh, how can it be a classic if you don't have touchdowns or big plays? Well, you must not have been paying attention to these defenses. Yeah. You must not have been paying attention to these defensive lines. There were big plays all over the place.
I mean, for those people that are turned off by college football because it sometimes turns into a track meet, I mean, you have inflated scores, inflated numbers. That is the nature at times of college football. Those people also tend to love the NFL, so you have this difference in opinion there. But this was their type of game. This was an NFL type of game. And the truth is, there's a reason for that. The amount of talent that is going to be in the NFL, specifically on both defenses, made it that kind of game. So certainly it wasn't pretty at times. When you get no touchdowns, inevitably you're going to have an ugly game at times. But I thought it was everything that we wanted it to be, including an overtime game, mm-hmm. which people kind of were hinting, if we get an overtime game, then that's going to drive home this argument of should there be a rematch or not. But it was a great atmosphere and a great game for college football, I thought.
I loved the game. It obviously wasn't the game of the century, which has kind of become more of a sarcastic thing at this point. But it could easily be argued it was the game of the year, as different as it was from the Stanford-USC game and the Michigan State-Wisconsin game. It was a great game to watch. I was on the edge of my seat the entire time. What was funny, I'm talking to people on Twitter throughout the game, and people are saying, wow, this is enthralling stuff. And I said, I know, right? And they said I was being sarcastic. So it really, like you said, it goes to show you the difference in opinions, because I didn't realize they were being sarcastic. I thought it was enthralling the whole way.
I mean, you especially, I think that what I was reading, and I think there's a lot of validity to this, we come at this from the West Coast. We're based in Los Angeles. The West Coast and the Midwest hated on this game throughout it. You'd expect that kind of reaction. In the South, they loved it. From a West Coast perspective, I think it's a little bit ridiculous to say, as I've heard so many times, that it was these putrid offenses that were the reason it was a 9-6 game. That these teams, you know, they can't throw a forward pass, they have no idea how to play the game offensively, when in reality, against very good teams, you're talking about teams like Oregon and Arkansas and a pre-Armageddon Penn State and a lot of other teams that had a pulse. These offenses were averaging nearly 40 points a game. So I look at it,
Two top 15 offenses.
Sure. So, I mean, we can hear these varying points from all over the country, and I understand it. It was not the most entertaining game, but to suggest that it was only 9-6 because of how pitiful the offenses were, I just don't think that's accurate.
And it was almost, like you said, strictly geographical. Right. SEC country said, look at our great defenses. Yeah. Everybody else said, look at these terrible offenses. It might have been a little bit of both, but it was more 80-20 defenses than it was 50-50. Yeah. So I thought it was a great game. I enjoyed it. And you know, I have to say though, after that game, I don't need a rematch.
Yep.
As much as I enjoyed the game, I don't need a rematch because LSU came out on top. Now, you could argue with all the missed field goals by Alabama, they could have easily won that game. But the fact that LSU went into Alabama and beat them, you were saying last week, a great bring up by you, that if Alabama wins this game and then LSU wins the game in New Orleans, what did we really prove?
Yep.
Well, now I'm kind of saying LSU went on the road and beat Alabama, so I don't need anything else to be proven by a rematch. And sure, Alabama could go into LSU or at least go into New Orleans and win that game, but I don't need to see it personally.
For my money, I think these are the two best teams in college
football. I agree with
if that. If your goal is to put them on the field in a national championship, it's great to argue that there should be a rematch, but let's think about it like this. You're going to then make LSU beat Alabama twice to win a national championship, and whereas you're only going to make Alabama beat LSU once to win a national championship. I think that's unfair, because the reality is, if you only make Alabama...
And you're also making LSU win the SEC championship.
On what planet does it make sense that you're going to only make Alabama beat this team one time, whereas you're going to make LSU win that game twice to claim that they're the national champion? If we had a series, if we could make it a three-game series, fine, but we can't. And so that's the only reason that I don't think that the rematch should occur. Frankly, I do think these are the two best teams. If your goal is to put the two best teams in the country on the field for a national championship, I certainly don't think that them being in the same division should keep it from happening.
Okay, I agree with that. I agree that they're the two best teams in the country, but you said that the goal is to put the two best teams on the field. I think the goal is to put the two most deserving teams on the field, which you could certainly argue, obviously, and perhaps it is unfair.
That's what I'm saying. That's the difference in semantics. What is your goal if you're the BCS? Is it because I think you're right. The BCS is set up to put the two teams that are deserving based on the system on the field. It doesn't mean you're going to get the two best teams. So under this system, the rematch just isn't going to happen. It's just how it is. The BCS is set up to put a team from the SEC against what will likely be, if we get it, an Oklahoma State or a Stanford. But if it doesn't happen, you're going to get a one-loss team that probably still wouldn't be Alabama.
See, and that's where I would have a problem.
Right.
Because if Oklahoma State runs the table, Stanford runs the table, we've both been proponents of the fact that, yeah, maybe those teams aren't as good as Alabama, but if you run the table in a BCS conference with the system in place as it is, like you're talking about, then those teams deserve a shot. But if we're talking about an undefeated Boise State beating essentially nobody, or everybody losing a game and putting a one-loss Oklahoma in there just because you don't want to see a rematch, that's bogus.
And that's where I would love to take on the people that say that it's the division that gets them, because I would love to sit down and discuss why, under that exact scenario you just pointed out, why we have to put Oklahoma in there, because somehow it's LSU and Alabama's fault that they play in the same division.
Right.
It's like the AL East of college football.
Yeah.
You're going to tell me that the Yankees, that the Yankees and the Red Sox can't make the playoffs if they're the two best teams. I mean, in that scenario, you can if there's a wild wild card. For us, we're telling you, you can't, because the division's the only thing that decides it.
Yeah. It's asinine. It's punishing the two teams for being in the same conference. Right. They didn't decide that. Right. If Alabama and LSU could have just picked, say, 12 games, and they didn't pick each other, they would have gone undefeated. Right. So nobody else was going to beat them in the regular season, in all likelihood, other than perhaps Arkansas or LSU. We'll see what happens in that one. But before we get into these BCS standings, just some other things that happened last week. Kellen Moore, 46-2. Man, I mean, the most wins all time in college football. He's probably going to pick up four more in the regular season, and then his bowl game, so he'll get to 50 wins in all likelihood. Incredible career, and you can say what you want about his competition, but 46-2 in college football, and the way he's done it, easily one of the greatest college quarterbacks of all time, arguably the best.
You know, he's just a winner. I'm not going to say he's the quarterback I would select as the best of all time, but what I will say is that his mind is as sharp as Andrew Luck's. I mean, he's not as big as Andrew Luck. He's not as mobile as Andrew Luck, and that's the reason that who knows what his draft status is going to be. But when you talk about how great Andrew Luck's mind is, and we talk about that all the time, that he's the smartest quarterback in the country, I would suggest that Kellen Moore, if he does trail Andrew Luck in that category, it's not by much, because he is just as great at thinking through a football game as Andrew Luck is, and I think that's part of why he's won as many games as he has.
Kellen Moore, anybody that would argue that, you know, his stats and what he's done is just based on easy competition, I challenge you to watch every game he's played against a tough opponent.
Yeah.
The Georgias and Oregons and TCUs, and he always rises to the occasion. He can always be counted on late in the game. He's an incredible player, and I hope he gets a shot at the next level, because honestly, he does have a ton of compete, and we're saying it not in the way that you say, oh, the kid's a winner, like it's just a consolation prize. He really is a winner. I think he can be at the NFL level, too.
He is. You know, the NFL, obviously, it's fickle with how they do things, and their evaluation is based on a completely different standard than anything that 46-2 is going to tell them. They'll look at that. They'll think it's great. They have a whole other way of measuring quarterbacks. But, you know, this guy, every team that he's been on in these last few years with Boise, and it's changed. The personnel's changed. This year, it's totally different. They all rally behind him.
Yeah, for them to go into that Georgia game with so many different weapons on offense and to just not skip a beat, that's Kellen Moore, is what that was. Oklahoma, 41-25 against Texas A&M. Once again, just steamrolling a very good team. Once again, just putting that loss in their rearview mirror. And like we alluded to, they're the team that in an Armageddon situation probably gets in there, whether we like it or not.
Yeah, I mean, this is what they do. This is what Bob Stoops is known for. And you know what? Bob Stoops didn't freak out over the Texas Tech game.
No.
And I don't think he was never going to. He always had his eye on exactly what could play
out.
Even
after Skip Bayless called for his head, you don't think that bothered him?
I don't think Bob Stoops listens to Skip Bayless. But no, I mean, you know, he's got his eye on the prize. And Oklahoma has a very realistic shot to still position themselves right there at the end for a national championship, whether we like it or not. The loss is probably not going to be the best loss of the one-loss teams. If all those teams have a loss, their loss is not going to look nearly as good as some of the others. But Oklahoma was the preseason number one team. They lost Ryan Broyles, which is a huge loss, and that could actually be the reason that they get a second loss before the season's over. But they're right there, and it wouldn't stun me if they found themselves in New Orleans somehow.
And of course, everybody who hated the Alabama-LSU game had plenty of entertainment in arguably the game of the week. If you didn't like defense, Oklahoma State, Kansas State going right down to the wire, trading blows for blows. Oklahoma State ends up holding on 52-45. Kansas State had some big chances first and goal to tie that game up. I wonder if they would have gone for two there, because beating Oklahoma State in overtime would be a tall task, especially with the way the offense was clicking. I almost think Bill Snyder would have gone for two there, and that could have been dangerous.
I mean, we love Bill Snyder, and the rule of thumb is usually if you're on the road, go for two. It wouldn't have stunned me at all if they would have gone for two, especially because the point that comes out of this game for me is Oklahoma State got pushed around on the line of scrimmage mm-hmm. in this game. They lost the turnover battle. They finally lost the turnover
battle. Yeah, they finally came back down to earth a little bit.
I mean, which, you know, they turned it over four times. And the Cowboys defense gave up 507 yards of offense. Again, they were pushed around against a Kansas State team that obviously likes to establish the run. But when you watch this team, as good as Brandon Weeden is and as good as Justin Blackmon is, who, by the way, should probably be invited to New York City by the season's end.
Of course.
But I just don't know if we can buy into them as a legitimate threat to win a national championship if they're going to lose the line of scrimmage as often as they do. I don't know what this team is going to need to become in order to win a game against Alabama or LSU, because I don't think they can assert their will in that type of game against like an LSU, obviously, now. But will they be able to eventually cut down on these yards that they're giving up?
No, I don't think so. I really don't. I mean, I love Oklahoma State. I love the way they play the game. This is the type of team that got me into college football. The problem is, it's not the type of team that wins a championship going up against a team that is a defensive powerhouse that has a month to prepare for you. That game honestly doesn't interest me at all. As much as I just said I don't need to see a rematch between LSU-Alabama, LSU-Oklahoma State is lower than LSU-Stanford, obviously, which is my preferred matchup. It's lower than LSU-Boise State for me, honestly. I'd rather see what Boise State can do against that team, because I think Oklahoma State is a terrible matchup against LSU for all the reasons you just illustrated.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, the issue is, and we're not trying to hate on Oklahoma State.
No, and they really deserve to be the two spot, 100%. They're really killing great competition. Yeah. They're blowing teams out. Their offense is awesome. But proceed.
We've been with them for many games this season. The issue is, imagine a guy like Jordan Jefferson. Oklahoma State has now shown time and time again that they struggle against mobile quarterbacks. They're going to see a mobile quarterback against Iowa State. They're going to get a few more tests before the season's done. But Jordan Jefferson and that LSU offensive line and what they do with their different running backs, their different style of running backs, to control the line of scrimmage is going to be such a piece of cake for LSU in a game like that it just does kind of make you a little bit disheartened by the possibility of that game happening, especially when it would be a home game essentially for LSU. So again, Boise State, Stanford, you want to make a case that the game would be in a little bit more of an entertaining and balanced battle in those games. This one just doesn't seem like it would happen, even though I'm sure that we'd see Justin Blackmon get his yards against very good secondary players. But that's about the only thing that would be a fun matchup to watch in that one.
Yeah, it would be. And we'd probably see Weeden, like you said, as good as he is, we'd probably see him turn the ball over two or three times. And LSU probably wins that one by double digits. Looking at the BCS standings, perhaps the most interesting thing to come out of that game of the century was the fact that Alabama didn't go down very far. In the BCS standings, they went from 2-3. Yeah. Oklahoma State jumped them. Oklahoma State obviously controls their own destiny at this point. They have to beat Texas Tech on the road, Iowa State on the road, and then that big game against Oklahoma, of course. Alabama is slightly ahead of Stanford. If you look at the decimal points in the BCS, Alabama coming in at 8836, Stanford coming in at 8749. But the most interesting thing, Boise State coming in at 8473. If Stanford beats Oregon this week, I can't imagine they don't jump Alabama. That's way too big of a win.
Yeah.
Of course, Stanford still has the Notre Dame game to end their season, which gives them more points. But looking at the discrepancy between Alabama and Boise State, Alabama with 8836, Boise State with 8473. And just to clarify again, I'm just looking at the computer BCS numbers, which I don't understand either. Yeah. But that's obviously a somewhat noticeable discrepancy. Even if Boise State gains some ground beating TCU at home, that's not a good enough win. I don't think that's as good as a win as Alabama going on the road and beating Auburn in the Iron Bowl.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't even think Boise State can get ahead of Alabama this week. But even if they did, I would think a win over Auburn for Alabama would trump Boise State's win over New Mexico in their finale. So, if Oklahoma State and Stanford lose, could we see a rematch of Alabama before we see Boise State in there?
That's the question, because you would think the system's set up to keep that from happening. It'd be interesting to see where a team like Oklahoma, if they were to beat Oklahoma State, kind of jump could that give them? Because I still think that's a very real scenario when you get that kind of a win over Oklahoma State from the computer number perspective. I just can't make it a way in my head for Boise State to get the necessary points to jump these teams. It's so difficult because this TCU game was supposed to be their chance that if they won it wherever they were positioned, and five, you know, if you really think about it, if they were positioned at five at the beginning of the season, and they thought that that game against TCU at number five was going to be their game, they probably feel pretty good about that. The issue is the TCU win isn't going to give them the juice that they need anymore. And even like you said, if it gave them a little bit this week, I'm not even sure if beating TCU would allow them to pass Alabama this week.
No.
But even if it did, by the time Bama gets to Auburn, I think it goes the other way on them. It's unfortunate. We just talked about Kellen Moore, and all of those words are true. But how do we make a case to get Boise State ahead of these other teams with the numbers as we see them right now? I just don't know how to do it.
If Oregon goes on the road and beats Stanford, and then the following week they beat USC,
yep,
couldn't you put them ahead of Boise State? I mean, I'm not saying they're going to get in there. It would take an awful lot to get them in there. But I'm just saying from a strictly ranking perspective, their only loss is to LSU, and they have more signature wins.
Yeah, and it may not be meaningful in the national title discussion,
right,
but yes, I think the answer is yes, and I don't love saying that,
right,
but I think that even Oregon, and you could look at Oregon and Arkansas conceivably passing Boise without much of a problem, so you know, this is a difficult situation for Boise State because we've pointed towards this game that they're about to play this week. We've pointed to it all season as being a make or break point in their season. And right now, it's kind of an afterthought because we can't even figure out a way for them to get anything out of it this next BCS standings.
Yeah, there's not much. I mean, and it gets back to the argument we've had before about is it good to beat a team by a little or by a lot. If Boise State crushes TCU, now TCU's a three-loss team.
Yeah.
Lost to Baylor, who's kind of falling apart a little bit down the stretch here. They did get the big win over Missouri last week, but they're going to end up with four or five losses. And then SMU, who really hasn't looked sharp over the last few weeks. So, you know, this would be a TCU team all of a sudden that wouldn't be that strong.
The only help that I can envision Boise State getting is if somehow Georgia was to win the SEC.
Yeah.
And if Georgia won the SEC, then maybe Boise State gets enough of a boost because what you're hoping for at that point is that the SEC is left altogether out of the national championship.
Yeah.
And maybe there's a chance.
If two spots were open for them, you got to figure they could get in there that way. But it would also be kind of fun to see in practice just how much that strength of schedule really means to these computers, because we'll see Boise State sitting at home, and we'll see Georgia going up against probably LSU, and if Georgia beats LSU while Boise State is sitting at home doing nothing, be interesting to see what happened in the BCS standings for Boise State,
yeah,
and it would kind of give us a precedent moving forward as to just how much that strength schedule means. But I think Boise State's one of the most fascinating stories left here, because Oklahoma State obviously controls their own destiny. Stanford needs an Oklahoma State loss, especially after the ASU loss to UCLA. My apologies for bringing that up, but that really hurts the Pac-12 championship game win for Stanford or Oregon. Stanford won't need it if they're undefeated because nothing would change, but it hurts a team like Oregon that, you know, with that one loss, that win in the Pac-12 South isn't going to be as much or isn't going to mean as much. Boise State is the team that it looks like they're going to go undefeated. They're going to be a double-digit favorite in every game down the stretch, obviously. They're a 14-point favorite this week. They're the team that's going to be in this conversation if Oklahoma State and Stanford lose. Stanford, we're going to talk about them, but that could be this week. And Oklahoma State has the Oklahoma game at the end of the season. And Texas Tech, we know what they can do. We saw what they did to Oklahoma, so it could happen.
Yeah, an undefeated Boise at the end of the year being left out of a national championship, probably winning in the Fiesta Bowl or something. It's just the same old story, so let's run it again.
It's just college football. Yeah, let's just go over it one more time. So obviously the game of the week and arguably the game of the season, and if you didn't like the LSU-Alabama game because you didn't like defense, you shouldn't have that problem when Stanford and Oregon take the field this Saturday. Three of the last four games between these two teams have had 80-plus points of scoring. five of the last six have gone over 60 points of scoring. So we should see plenty of scoring in this one. A very exciting game. I'm obviously, as a fan of the Pac-12 and of both of these teams, excited to see it. What are you thinking right now on this game?
I mean, it's just a classic power versus speed game. It's the same story as it is every year with these two teams. You know, Oregon has won 18 straight conference games dating back to 2 years ago when they lost this game to Stanford on the farm. They gave up 51 points in that one. And the Ducks have never beaten a top five team on the road. Stanford comes in with the longest winning streak in the country. And yet, there are question marks on both sides for this game. As good as these teams have been, they don't come into this game without plenty of people wondering, for example, for Oregon, how is Darren Thomas going to play? I mean, what's his role in this game going to be? Since he got hurt against Arizona State, he really hasn't been the same. Last week, he was solid, looked like he was starting to get back to his style of play, but he wasn't asked to do that much. He went 13 of 25, 169 yards and a touchdown, and really relied on the resurgence of LaMichael James to carry the load. And for Stanford, how are they going to deal with the speed and the one-on-one matchups in space against Oregon? They failed that task miserably for the final three quarters of last year's game, getting outscored 49-10 at Autzen. Will they be better this year without Shane Scove? And again, I seemingly ask this every week, but will the injury to Shane Scove finally matter in a game?
And of course, the injury last week to Chris Owusu. It looks like Levine Toilolo is going to play after leaving the last week's game with an injury, but Owusu won't. And that's just one less weapon after they lost Zach Ertz the week before. It's tough to go up against a team like Oregon at less than 100%, and you're missing two of your best players on offense and your best player on defense. Extremely tall task. Throughout the week, before we came on the air here, we were kind of talking about how both of us think that Oregon's going to win this game. I don't know about you, but I've actually done a 180 on that. I've come back around, and I actually think Stanford is going to win this game. And part of that is whether or not it is going to catch up to them on defense that Shane Scove is out, because this Stanford team, to this point in the season, is third in the nation against the rush, behind only Alabama and LSU. And they faced some pretty darn good rushing teams in the Pac-12. They're not going to hold Oregon to 79 rushing yards. That goes without saying. But if they can even slow them down a little bit and force Darren Thomas to make plays, I don't know that he will make those plays. And I do think that Stanford will make those plays on offense.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Stanford is a legitimate top 20 defense overall. Certainly they've been great against the run. You know, the question's going to be with the Ducks rushing attack back to full speed, because when LaMichael James is back to full speed, your entire offense is back to full speed. You match that with the fact that Barner and Thomas, the backups, in his absence, in LaMichael James' absence, they were playing at an extremely high level. Yep. So you have three very difficult backs to deal with, and they play a style that kind of goes against why Stanford has become third in the country in rush defense. They do it in space. They do it one-on-one. And that's going to be the question that Stanford has to answer this week. They didn't answer it very well last year. The safety, a starting safety for Stanford, Michael Thomas, who's been a big part of their defense, he said straight up, right now everyone's not playing well together. Guys are playing well, but we're not playing well together. And the thing that I think strikes me about that statement and why he said it is to beat Oregon and to play well against an Oregon offense, your entire defense has to be completely in sync. You can't have one or two standout players. Everyone has to be playing
on the same
page.
Everybody has to be swarming the ball. Everybody has to be focused. Absolutely.
If they're not up to that task at home in an environment that has improved, but it's not the hardest place to play on the road, I certainly think that the farm will be rocking a little bit. But this is Stanford. This is still a home field advantage that leaves a lot to be desired. So will this defense be up to the task of staying one-on-one in space with all of this speed? And I think they're thinking the same thing right now.
Yeah, speed versus power often goes the way of speed, because you know a power team can look slow if you get to the outside on them, and that's obviously a concern. I'd also point out, you know, as much as every time Stanford takes the field, you can say Andrew Luck is the best player on the field. It's not by much when LaMichael James is out there.
Right.
I mean, last year, you know, Cam Newton won the Heisman Trophy. Andrew Luck came in second. LaMichael James came in third. If LaMichael James hadn't have suffered that elbow injury, he came into that game, and he'd already in the Cal game, he got injured and missed the entire fourth quarter. He already rushed for 200 yards in that game, his third straight game that he rushed for 200 yards. If he doesn't leave that game with an injury, he's right there in the Heisman conversation. An Oregon win here would arguably make him the favorite. So two great players on both sides of the ball. I actually think, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, that it's the other side of the ball. Even with the injuries, Oregon is averaging 149 rushing yards against per game. LSU rushed for 175 yards against them. And as much as Stanford to the layman is known for Andrew Luck and is just known, you know, as a team that can pass the ball or whatever, this is a running team with a powerful set of backs. Another team, they're a lot different than the Oregon stable, but it's a stable full of capable backs. I don't think Oregon can contain this rushing attack. I think where Stanford's power comes into play is on that offensive line, where they can push around this athletic defensive line a little bit, control the tempo of the game when they're on offense, and while it won't be a conventional speed type of shootout, I think it is a shootout because I don't know that Oregon gets off the field against this team.
Yeah. There are two reasons that I like Stanford this week. Although, I will say, like you, I went back and forth about 15 times
yeah.
on this game. But the two reasons that I like Stanford, even though Oregon forced Andrew Luck to throw two picks last year, which, by the way, it was his only multi-pick game since then, and the second time it's happened in 34 starts. So
wow.
it gives you a good idea of why Oregon won last year. But Stanford is a balanced offense, a truly balanced offense. They throw for 280 yards a game, and they rush for over 220 yards. So if you're the defensive coordinator for Oregon, Nick Aliotti, there is a zero tolerance policy on letting Stanford get into comfortable downs. You cannot do it or you're going to get killed. And I'm not convinced, like you said, that a team that isn't that stout up front right now in the defensive line is going to be able to keep Stanford from doing what they love to do the most, which is gaining about 6 yards on first down. To me, the key to this game is going to be first and third down of when Stanford's offense is on the field. On first down, Stanford loves to gain about 5 to 6 yards, and then their entire playbook opens up. They can run anything, and the playbook is like a dictionary-sized playbook, so that's a lot that they can choose from. And then it becomes a guessing game. The offense averages 5.7 yards a carry, so that's a ton of second and third and shorts that they get into. And, you know, as much as we talk about Andrew Luck being the face of this team, and everybody seems to almost think he's the only player on this team, what about Stephon Taylor?
Incredible season
he's averaging
having.
Over 6 yards a game, a carry, and he's run for 900 yards this season. He's probably going to go over 1,000 in this game.
Absolutely.
He's a key reason why not only is Andrew Luck going to benefit from that, but I think that this Stanford team is truly one of the most, if not the most balanced offense in the country. If Oregon can get them into third and long, then you can get the only weakness Andrew Luck has into play here, which is they come after him with 5, 6, 7, maybe even 8 rushers, and the receivers on Stanford, not the tight ends, but just the wide receivers, they're not the best unit in the country. So if you can get Andrew Luck into 3rd and 10, 3rd and 12, and you match up one-on-one with their receivers,
especially
and
with Owusu out.
Yeah, bring a lot of heat. Owusu's not playing, then maybe you have a chance, especially since, you know, as they call it, trees company with Ertz, Fleener, and Tuilolo. If, you know, with Ertz being out, that's a huge part of what Stanford likes to do on second and third and short. But I just don't know if Oregon has the personnel to stop them from getting into very comfortable and manageable downs.
Yeah, you can't say enough about the Zach Ertz injury and even Levine Tuilolo being less than 100%, because, you know, when Zach Ertz went down, you were in my ear about it, how big of an injury that was. Yeah, and as I started to research it, you know, Stanford runs about 25 to 30% of their plays are out of that triple tight end formation. So, you know, if you're running 1.5 tight ends out of your triple tight end formation, that is a big deal. I just think that the running game is going to be able to control the tempo of this game. If it doesn't, then you're right. If Oregon can get into their comfort zone on defense, which is swarming and letting that speed kill, sending a lot of guys, playing zone, then Stanford could get into some trouble. But I don't think so. I think Stanford's going to control the tempo running the ball, and then, God forbid you start cheating run, you know, good luck against Andrew Luck there, regardless of the receiving core.
Nick Aliotti's one of the best defensive coordinators in the country at dialing up third down blitzes.
Yep.
But it has to be on third and long for him to be able to do that. And I like USC's personnel on the defensive line more than I like this Oregon team. And Stanford found a way to run the ball against that team. And if they can run it against USC with their defensive line, I think they can do the same thing against Oregon. And it's the only reason that I'm picking Stanford, because there is a lot to like about the one-on-one matchups that could happen in this game for Oregon. The speed is there. I still think that what they did last year, even on the road, could happen again, where they're getting guys in space. But I think that Stanford, this is where we talked about wanting one of the most meaningless stats in football, as I said about it last week, which is time of possession. But this is one of those games where time of possession may come in handy for Stanford. They average about 33 minutes of possession to Oregon's 23:52. That extra 10 minutes of being able to control the ball and run it with Oregon on the sideline actually could be big.
In this game, they are going to win the time of possession battle. And like you said, it could factor in. Now, you just said it's the only reason you're taking Stanford. Did you mean it's the only reason you're leaning Stanford, or are you with me on Stanford now?
What I think in this
because
game...
Because, like you said, I could go back and forth. If we recorded this podcast 6 hours ago, we might have both been on Oregon, so...
The injury to Ertz, as big as it is, because that is 30% of their playbook, and they, unlike any other team in the country, can use three tight ends and do things that no one's seen with them. But... without Ertz, they can still run the ball, I think, against this Oregon defense. And that, mixed in with Andrew Luck being able to get into his comfort plays in passing and that huge playbook that they have available to them, is the reason that I think they have enough to persevere. But, man, this is one of those games that could be a true shootout like we've been accustomed to with these teams.
Apologize for putting words in your mouth saying you were on Oregon. Another thing you have to mention here about Stanford, the revenge factor is huge. I mean, that game... in Eugene, they jump out to the big lead early, and if they hold on to it, it's Stanford in the national championship last year. That was Stanford's only loss, and that's going to be fresh on their mind. A lot of returning players on this team that have been licking their chops waiting for this Oregon team, and that definitely factors in. I'd also like to point out that you're right, the farm isn't the most dangerous road environment in the world, but Oregon is not the same team on the road. And it doesn't matter if it's a neutral field or if they just played it in a backyard. They feed off of that crowd in Eugene like nobody's business. And even if it's not the road crowd getting in their ear so much as it's just not having that boost from the home crowd, that does factor in here.
I mean, I think that what you heard from Michael Thomas, the safety, I think those words are exactly why Stanford is viewing this as a revenge game, because they really talked all week about how important it is to play better defense. They're ranked third against the run, and they don't think they're playing very well, and I think they're using all of this as motivation that if we don't get it together, if we don't play our best game of the season, we're not going to beat this team, and I think that's why they will play their best game of the season.
And you almost like to hear that, because for some teams, it's more about the swagger. You know, if you heard something like that from an Oregon player, it would kind of feel out of place. But this Stanford team is a blue-collar team. They're going to have to go out there and beat you with gritty football. And you almost like to hear them being down to earth and saying, hey, you know, yeah, we're 9-0, and they're not going to mention the spread, but they've covered the spread in every game. They're doing pretty darn good this season, but they're not going to toot their own horn. They're going to go out there and say, we need to improve. We need to get better. Obviously, we do need to mention, you were mentioning, of course, that Oregon had won 18 straight in the Pac-12. They've won 8 of the last 9 against Stanford. And now Stanford's come a long way since some of those earlier ones. But this Oregon team does have the Stanford team pegged. Stanford has had trouble defending this team, as would be expected with a team with so much speed. So, plenty of reasons to like both of these teams. You got a final score prediction?
Well, it wouldn't surprise me if we saw a similar score to what we saw 2 years ago. I mean, I don't know if it'll be 51-42 or something like that, but I could see this game getting into the 40s, and I think Stanford outlasts them something like 48-44 even.
Yeah, I agree. I think it does get into the 40s, maybe Oregon into the high 30s. I think something along the lines of, say, Stanford 45, Oregon 38, I'll say. But it should be a very entertaining game. And one of those games, a lot like the Alabama-LSU game, I think that if you play it 7 times, it goes to a game 7.
Yeah.
Which, you know, you can't say about all games, but this one really is a coin flip and should be a blast.
So let's get into our quick hits, and starting with biggest surprise, as we normally do, I have to say that I watched Northwestern go into Lincoln, Nebraska, and upset the 10th-ranked Nebraska Cornhuskers. That's my surprise, but more importantly, Northwestern outrushed Nebraska at home 207-122 in yards rushing. I don't know about you, but that stat alone surprises me.
Nothing surprises me about this Nebraska defense anymore because I just don't get it, especially coming off that Michigan State game. But the Big Ten, it's just become this conference, obviously leaving the stuff off the field aside for a second, it's become this conference of letdown game after letdown game. It's like a snowball effect where every week, you know, somebody's having a letdown game against somebody else. Nebraska delivers one to Michigan State coming off of the 2 big wins, and then Nebraska loses to a Northwestern team that really hasn't shown much of a pulse this season.
No,
and like you said, so maybe that was predictable, but to do it on the ground, it is surprising. But then at the same time, the Nebraska defense this year has been pretty lousy, which is maybe an even bigger surprise considering what Bo Pelini has kind of built this team around.
I mean, he's a defensive coach, and what happened in this game is 3 separate Northwestern quarterbacks combined to throw 1 touchdown and 2 interceptions, and yet somehow they still won the game 28-25. I mean, Taylor Martinez, it was such a wacky day. Usually his day is on the ground. He throws for 289 yards and 2 touchdowns, does pretty well there, only runs for 54 yards. It was just a weird, twisted, turned game. I certainly, if Northwestern was to win it, which they did, I wouldn't have thought it would be the way that they did it. But with Nebraska, you never know.
I almost wonder if it was maybe a sandwich game type of thing, because you had the Michigan State game last week. You knew 8-1 Penn State was coming up. You were going into that game with the huge Big Ten implications. So maybe they just overlooked Northwestern, or maybe they figured if we're going to get beat, we're going to get beat by Persa's arm, so let's go out there and stop the pass. And they did, but apparently they left the run completely out to dry. My biggest surprise, what happened to West Virginia? You know, I keep trying to make a case for the Big East, which is deteriorating. We still haven't really made any time to talk about that here on the show, but West Virginia is the face of this conference, and they consistently flirt with being a great team. They had the awesome offensive performance against LSU, which I thought legitimized them. They went into the Syracuse game a couple weeks ago. I thought they were going to destroy Syracuse after being upset by them the year before. Syracuse beat them 49-23, which was a massive surprise. They bounced back with a win against Rutgers 2 weeks ago, but it wasn't a great win. That was a tough win for them against the team they probably should have beat comfortably. And then last week, they're at home against Louisville. They're a 13-point favorite, and they lose 38-35. I guess I shouldn't be surprised by West Virginia not living up to expectations, because they always seem not to, but I kind of was. Geno Smith, I really thought after the first 5-6 games of the season, he was really establishing himself as a star in college football, and that this West Virginia team could be a two-loss type of team that could actually make the Big East proud come bowl season. Now they might not even go to a BCS bowl, and they certainly don't look like they can beat anybody of stature, considering they lost to Syracuse and Louisville.
I mean, when you're the face of a conference, they won't be the face much longer, but for now they are. You can't afford to tank to the degree that they have. And the reality is, I loved Geno Smith coming into this season, and he lit it up against LSU. You know, the turnovers were a factor, but he still had the yards. But no, I mean, this team just doesn't seem to think that they have a whole lot left to play for. They're not playing with a whole lot of fire or energy. The talent is there with West Virginia on many years, and this year included, but they've played down to the level of their competition, and now it just looks like they're just trying to round out the year and move on to another conference.
Maybe. The game I'm looking forward to this week, that Boise State-TCU game, you know, this is a down year for TCU, there's no question about that, especially on defense. But these two teams have a history of playing some excellent games, and I expect TCU to rise to the occasion here. These are two of the best coaches in college football. Both of these guys are going to have a game plan. It's not like they've had a whole lot of tough games lately that they've had to deal with, so you know they've both been thinking about this game. And you know, as much as I have nothing but great things to say about Kellen Moore and Boise State, if you look at the way they've been beating up on some of these teams, the Air Force game was close for a little while. UNLV, they probably should have beat 62-0. Now, I know it's semantics here. We're just talking about style points. But the UNLV game was actually close in the second quarter. Boise State hasn't been the sharpest we've seen them. And granted, what do you expect from them going up against lousy teams every week? But this TCU game is by far the toughest they've had since Georgia. And I actually think it could be a close game. Boise State's the more well-rounded team. At home on the blue turf, they should win it. But I think it's going to be a good game. I think it'll be a better game than the 14-point spread indicates.
Well, we've seen that Boise State has lost games late in the season to a team like Nevada, for example. And it was a similar feeling game in that Nevada built that one up. They prepared very well for that Boise State team last year. I don't see any reason why TCU can't give a similar effort. I think this has been on their radar for a while. I think that the scouting and the coaching is right there. They have an excellent coaching staff at TCU. I know that they'll be ready for this. And the question is, will they make the plays when they have to against a quarterback that doesn't give you a whole lot of chances at turnovers and mistakes in Kellen Moore? I think that Boise State will win this game. I don't think it's going to be enough to do anything that they wanted out of this win, but I just believe that Boise State, that coaching staff and that quarterback and the way they prepare, they're going to be ready to win this game. I won't say convincingly, but I think they're going to win it in a way that says we're the better team, we're going to finish out our season undefeated and put us where you will. And that's nothing against TCU. It's more I just believe that much in Boise State.
I agree, but you know, you just look at TCU, they have two losses. Both very close games against Baylor and SMU, two very creative teams on offense, which Boise State obviously is as well. But those were two out-of-conference games. TCU still undefeated in the Mountain West. They'd love to have their farewell tour in the Mountain West end in a championship, Mountain West championship. And they'll fight hard for it. So I agree. Boise State's the more well-rounded team. This is a statement game for them. They don't lose it at home. Could come down to the wire, though.
You know, for me, I'm looking at Auburn and Georgia this week, and it's a game in the SEC that, people are looking at probably because Georgia right now has a chance this week to clinch the SEC East with a little bit of help. South Carolina losing last week was a big shot in the arm for Georgia, who is getting healthier. I mean, Georgia now, with Mark Richt left for dead earlier in the season, has his Bulldogs position to compete and maybe even win an SEC championship, and they get good news this week with Isaiah Crowell, the standout freshman running back, being back after a one-game suspension. That South Carolina loss, I mean, it was huge for Georgia, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it just goes to show you how busy of a week it is in college football when an SEC matchup between two top 10 teams fell off our radar. We didn't get to it until our second hour here. That Arkansas win was huge for them, too. But yeah, Georgia now in position with this win to essentially win the SEC East, because even if South Carolina does bounce back and beat Florida, Georgia's not going to lose to Kentucky at home next week. This Kentucky team is down. Georgia's going to win that game. So if Georgia wins this one, it's theirs. And with the way they're playing, with the way they've been rolling since the early season hiccups, they could potentially make the SEC championship game a little interesting.
I mean, Auburn is ranked 85th nationally against the run. Crowell being back figures to play a huge role in this game. And if he gets going, Aaron Murray should be able to provide the rest. He's been very solid this season, 23 touchdowns, over 2,000 yards passing in a balanced offense. Georgia's won 4 of the last 5 in this series, and you just get the feeling after beating Florida, that's such a huge win for a program like Georgia that couldn't get over the hump in that one for a long time. You get the feeling they're ready to turn the corner and finish this season on a high note. The game against Georgia Tech is still huge, but it has no effect on the SEC East race. So if Florida beats South Carolina and Georgia wins this one, they're going to be in the Georgia Dome in Atlanta, where the Dogs play pretty well. They lost to Boise State in the opener, but outside of that, they are very good in that building. And you wonder, could they give one of those powerhouses from the West a battle? I mean, this is the 7th ranked defense in the country on top of having a balanced offense. So there's a lot to like about Georgia.
Yeah, I think they win this one this week, and I think we find out.
So moving on to upset alert, and as I look at mine, Michigan State goes to Iowa this week, where there's a history of this game never going Michigan State's way. When they go to Kinnick Stadium, they don't win. They've lost 7 straight at Iowa. They lost last year 37-6 to the then, you know, to their defense, then number 18 ranked Hawkeyes. But that was the Spartans' only regular season defeat, and it cost them a trip to a BCS bowl. I love Iowa in this game. Again, they're coming off of a win against Michigan, feeling pretty good about themselves. This is a chance that Michigan State has to secure the Legends division, at least stay on top of it. They have a berth in the conference championship game on the line, potentially down the road. It's a roadblock that really is their only one. If you look at it, they have a game that, you know, coming up in the next few weeks. They play Indiana, they play Northwestern, so this really is their chance to put a stronghold on that division. I'm not sure that they can do it against this team in Iowa this week.
Yeah, I wonder. I do think Michigan State's the better team, but there's something about this type of game, you know, and there's something about just the way Iowa is going to carry themselves. And even if you prepare for the game and you know they're Michigan State's, you know, not going to go in scared per se, but it's always in the back of your mind. The players can say what they want about not thinking about the past, but you know that you haven't beat this team here forever. Yeah. So I agree with you. Iowa has a great shot in this one.
I mean, the Spartans were held to 258 yards last year, a season low, 31 on the ground. Kirk Cousins was picked 3 times. This is very reminiscent of when Wisconsin went into Michigan State. They come off of a loss the last year in the same stadium. It's the same thing, 2 years in a row playing in the same stadium, and you get the feeling that Iowa might have the magic again. They did it to Michigan last week. They might do it to Michigan State again this week. It's certainly something to keep an eye on.
I agree, and a much less likely upset, but an upset alert nonetheless. You know, Oklahoma State going into Texas Tech, we've kind of had a good laugh about this. The Texas Tech, they win that Oklahoma game, and they just fall off the face of the earth. They have a pathetic game against Iowa State. They follow that up with a pathetic performance against Texas. So now that we've all just thrown them in the garbage again and moved on with our lives, wouldn't it be fitting if now they just threw us all for another loop and beat another undefeated team out of Oklahoma?
It's totally within Tommy Tuberville's character to do just that.
He's 5-5 straight up against top 5 opponents. That's an incredible stat. I mean, to be 500 against top 5 opponents is remarkable. And, you know, that I just think, especially with what we saw in Oklahoma State's defense last week, it's what we talked about all along. Of course, I just said I was willing to tell them that their defense wasn't so bad. Well, it looks like it's pretty bad again. When the turnover battle isn't going your way and you're giving up a million yards, it doesn't look so good. The recipe for success for Texas Tech is the exact same in the Oklahoma game. And I'd argue, from an offensive perspective, it should be even easier, because this Oklahoma State defense doesn't hold a candle to Oklahoma's defense, which didn't show up for that one, of course. But that was on the road. Now they're at home. They owe their home crowd a big game after that Iowa State sucker game.
Yeah.
So, you know, if Texas Tech comes out firing and this is a shootout, Oklahoma State can shoot out with anybody and probably does end up winning it, a lot like they did last week. But
to me, it comes down to Seth Dagey. If he plays well, and he played terrible against Iowa State, but if he plays well, he keeps his team in this game. They can shoot out with Oklahoma State. Like you said, they owe their fans a lot more than what they've given them recently. And if he plays well, then they do have a shot.
So a little bit of everything here on episode 10 of Running the Option. I'm Dave Consolazio. This is Sam Saig. We appreciate you listening, as always. As always, you can email me at vegasdavesdime@gmail.com.
And you can email me at samsaig@gmail.com.
If you have any questions or comments, thank you guys so much for listening. Hope to have you back next week.
Take care, everybody.